All right, we're studying the book of Exodus in this class for a while now, and we've talked about before why we're doing this. Even though we're all New Testament types, we're studying an Old Testament book. We said, well, why are we doing that? We got 21 epistles we could go study. Why not go study one of them? And the answer is it's at least twofold. One reason, of course, we study the Old Testament books is because it's profitable. All Scripture is profitable. That's one reason. Second reason is that the Old Testament is very illustrative of the New Testament. That is, the Old Testament books illustrate to us the principles and doctrines that we have in our New Testament epistles. And so by studying them both, we get a better understanding of our New Testament doctrines and principles of life and so on that we have in the epistles, Romans through Jude. The setting in this book, as we've seen, is God's chosen people are being held captive. They're enslaved by the Egyptians. And the Egyptians are abusing them, using them as slave labor, and their life is very difficult and hard. And they have prayed to God for help, and he has heard their prayers, and he has stepped into the situation. He has come down to help out the Egyptians. To help out the Hebrews that are being held captive by the Egyptians. And he recruited a man to assist in that process, to be sort of his human agent. And that guy's name was Moses. We saw his background and his preparation and all that stuff. And even though he was a bit reluctant, came up with every excuse he could think of to not be involved with this mission, nevertheless, God pressed him into service, and he has gone back to Egypt along with his brother Aaron, and is making the demands of God known to Pharaoh there, the demands of God being, let my people go that they may worship me. So he goes and meets Pharaoh and tells him that initially, and things didn't go real well, did they? No, Pharaoh, in essence, blew him off, blew off God's demand, and actually increased the persecution and the pain and suffering inflicted on the Hebrews by increasing their workload and treating them badly. So the first meeting didn't go real well from Moses' perspective. Now, what has God told him about the way this thing was going to play out? Did God tell Moses that when you go in there and you tell him to let my people go the first time, he's going to let them go? That's not what he told him, was it? No, he told him he's not going to let them go. He's going to have to be compelled to let them go. So Moses should not maybe have expected some kind of a slam dunk on this deal, because that's not the way it's going to work out. Moses is going to be involved with God compelling Pharaoh to let the people go. And that compulsion is going to consist of 10 different plagues that we're going to start looking at here this morning. So the first meeting of the two was one in which God demonstrated his superiority over the gods of Egypt by having God's pet snake swallow their pet snakes. Remember that incident? Moses throws his staff down and becomes a snake. Pharaoh's magicians do the same thing, but Pharaoh's snake eats their snakes. You think maybe he would stop it? Yeah, Moses' snake ate theirs. You'd think he'd stop and think about that for a little bit, wouldn't you? But he didn't. He just blew it off. Seeing his magicians do a little bit, I guess, was all he needed. So he's going to have to have his arm twisted, and it will be twisted through these 10 miracles, these 10 plagues. We're going to start looking at those here this morning in chapter 7, verse 14. But before we do, let's talk a little bit about the plagues in general before we look at them specifically. These plagues are going to do a number of things for a number of people. First of all, these plagues are going to be educational. Who's going to get educated, and what are they going to learn? Well, listen to these references. 6, 7. You, Israel, shall know that I am the Lord your God. 7:5, the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord. 7:17, Pharaoh shall know that I am the Lord. 8:10, Pharaoh may know that there is no one like the Lord our God. 8:22, Pharaoh may know that I am the Lord in the midst of the earth. 9:14, Pharaoh will know that there is none like me in all the earth. 9:29. Pharaoh may know that the earth is the Lord's. 10:2. Moses and Israel may know that I am the Lord. 11:7. Moses and Israel may know that the Lord makes a distinction between the Egyptians and Israel. 14:4. The Egyptians will know that I am the Lord. And 14:8, the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I have gotten glory over Pharaoh, his chariots, and his horsemen. So everybody participating in the observance of these miracles, the Egyptians, their leader, the Hebrews, and their leader, are all going to be taught certain things about God through this experience. That he is superior to the gods of Egypt, that he is God Almighty, that he is in control of all the earth, a number of different things, as we'll see as we go along. So this will be a time of education for all of the participants in these events. Secondly, these 10 plagues are triumphant in nature. God is going to triumph over all of the gods of Egypt. 12:12. When all this is said and done at the end, all of the gods will know that the Lord has been at work. 12:12. For I'll go through the land of Egypt on that night and fatally strike all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the human firstborn to animals, and against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgments. I am the Lord. So God is going to triumph over them as well. So the plagues are educational. They are triumphant from God's perspective. Their character is miraculous. God specifically called these events miracles in 3:20. Not some sort of natural phenomenon on steroids, but they're miraculous. And he called them that. Later on, when he referred back to them, a little later on in the book of Exodus, he'll refer back to these incidents. In 14:22, he says, "Certainly my people who have seen my glory and my miracles, which I performed in Egypt in the wilderness, yet you have put me to the test these 10 times and have not listened to my voice." Deuteronomy 11:3, "And his miracles and his works which he did in the midst of Egypt to Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, and to all his land." And Deuteronomy 29:3, "The great trials which your eyes have seen, those great miracles and wonders." So he tells them ahead of time they're going to be miraculous. He tells them later, when he refers back to them, that they were miraculous. And some of the attempts to explain these miracles in human terms are just kind of almost ridiculous. Some people think that the first one we're going to see here in just a minute or two, turning the Nile to blood, was some kind of red algae floating on top of the water. Or the sunset was just in the right place so that the surface of the Nile looked like it was red. All the fish are going to die. The Nile's 25, 35 feet deep river. All of the fish down there 35 feet from the top, they're dead too. Is that caused by an algae on the top or the sun set reflecting off the water? That's crazy. These are miracles. God tells us they're miracles multiple times. So they're educational, they're triumphant, and they are miraculous in nature. Fourth point, they're punitive. They are designed to punish Egypt for their sins against God. Again, in 12:12 that we just saw, he says, "I'm going to triumph over all of the gods of Egypt. I will execute judgments. I am the Lord." So they're intended to be punitive, and they are punitive. And lastly, they are discriminatory. They're distinctive. They will apply to certain people and not certain other people. The Egyptians are going to get hammered by these plagues, but the Hebrews are not. God distinguishes between his people and people that are not his people through these plagues as well. And we'll see all of these traits as we go through them. So they're educational, they're triumphant, they're miraculous, they're punitive, and they are distinctive and discriminatory. All of these characteristics will be seen as we work our way through them. Now, they kind of unfold in three sets of three, And each of these three sets will be introduced by the expression, in the morning, go to Pharaoh and tell him thus and so. So in the morning starts a series of three plagues. In the morning starts a series of three more plagues. And in the morning starts a series of three more plagues. And then there's the last one that is really the final blow that we'll see later. Most of the plagues come with a warning. Two out of three in the first set of three do. Two out of three in the second set of three do. And two out of three in the third set of three do. And the last one, the tenth one, also comes with a warning. So Pharaoh has the opportunity of avoiding the pain and suffering that's going to be inflicted on his people by these plagues if he just heeds the warning. But he will not. As we'll see, that doesn't interest him so real very much. It looks like they take place over a period of about 9 months. That's what most of the commentators think if they consider what's happening to the crops and so on, at what times of the year they normally would be there and so on. You kind of come down with maybe a window of about 9 months that these plagues actually were executed over. And they're going to strike at, as we saw there in 12, all of the gods of Egypt. I stuck a page in your handout. It's called page 23, is a bunch of little pictures of some of the Egyptian gods. These names mean nothing to you unless you're an Egyptologist. Nobody in here is, I'm sure. But I just stuck that in there so you can see on that one page there's 28 different gods. There were about 80 known gods in Egypt, so they had a god for everything. Most of them were some kind of a bodily form with a frog head or a bull head or something like that. It doesn't matter so much which one of the gods is being attacked here. I could give you some names, but they won't matter to you, so you probably don't need to waste your time with them. The point is that all the gods of Egypt are going to be defeated by the Hebrews god. And there were multiple gods associated with various things, and so it's kind of hard to identify exactly which one god may be striking at most specifically. But at any rate, the bottom line is you swept all of their gods into a pile, and you had about 80 of them in that pile. God triumphs over all of them. All of the gods of Egypt are going to be humiliated by these plagues, regardless of their name and whatnot. Any questions about the plagues in general now before we start digging into them individually here? They have a multitude of effects on the Egyptians, on the Israelites, on their leaders, purposefully. And you notice one of those educational opportunities is for Moses. Remember, Moses came kind of kicking and screaming into this deal. He needs to kind of learn up some himself. So Moses is going to be a changed man after these plagues all take place than he was before. And so he's going to be a learner throughout all of this as well. Okay, let's dig into them. Plague number 1, verse 14 of Exodus chapter 7. Then the Lord said to Moses, Pharaoh's heart is stubborn. He refuses to let the people go. And we've seen him, he will harden his own heart 10 times before God hardens it once. But he tells him, Moses, go to Pharaoh in the morning. This is going to start, when you see that expression, in the morning, it's going to start a series of three. He's going out to the water and station yourself to meet him on the bank of the Nile. Now, why is Pharaoh going down to the water, do you think, the Nile River? Take a bath? Maybe. Probably he could have the water brought to him. I don't know, he'd have to go down there. The Nile is kind of the mother lode of the Egyptian false gods. It's the biggie. They have several main Egyptian idols associated with the Nile. He's probably going down there to offer homage to their main guy there at the Nile. And he tells Moses to take that staff that's in his hand with him, the one that he turned into a serpent. Now, the Nile is the most significant natural resource, of course, in all of Egypt. This river is about 4,000 miles long. See it? See it all the way down here? Starts down in Uganda, which would be about down here someplace. Flows about 4,000 miles all the way up through Egypt and ends up dumping up there in the Mediterranean. The Egyptians claim it's the longest river on earth, 4,000 plus miles. The Brazilians dispute that. They say the Amazon is, but we'll let them argue it out. It's a big river. It is a main economic and agricultural source of blessing for the nation. Every year when it floods into the riverbeds, fertilizes the land again and supports the crop growing in that country and all of that. So it's a major source of agriculture. It's a source of transportation to move grain up and down throughout the nation and all that sort of stuff. So it is a major, major economic asset. Can't see it all on this map. Doesn't go down far enough. But the part that they're interested in, of course, is the part they're going through Egypt, not the part all the way down south where it starts. So this is the biggie. This is the motherlode of Egyptian gods. So Moses is going to go out there and meet Pharaoh. He's got his staff with him. And the Lord tells him in verse 16, say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, this is not any of the Egyptian gods speaking here, it's the God of the Hebrews, says, has sent me saying, let my people go, that they may serve me in the wilderness. It is the purpose of God's elect, of his redeemed, to serve him. And so that's a reasonable request on his part, that his redeemed would be free to serve him and worship him. And they're going to do it in a way that they need to get out in the wilderness, because the way they do that would offend the Egyptians, and so they need to get away from them. And remind him that, behold, you've not listened until now. So thus says the Lord, by this you shall know that I am the Lord. This first miracle, this striking of the Nile, is to teach them that God is the supreme being here. And he says, Moses goes on and says, behold, I'll strike the water that is in the Nile with the staff that is in my hand, and it shall be turned to blood. He doesn't say, when I smack that water with this staff, it's going to get a red hue to it and make you think of blood. He says, it is going to become blood. Is that any stroke for God? It's a miracle. It is nothing for God to turn that 4,000-mile river. I don't know if the whole thing was turned to blood or not, but it would be no stroke if he wanted to. He is God. So he tells him what he's going to do. And furthermore, this is his first warning he gives him. Verse 18, the fish that are in the Nile will die, and the Nile will become foul, and the Egyptians will find difficulty in drinking water from the Nile. So their food source is going to be greatly disrupted. It's going to stink the whole country up when all that dead river life floats up to the surface and is laying rotting against the banks. And they're not going to have any water to drink. They're going to have to go start digging gypsy wells all over the place to try to find some more water after this event strikes. So the Lord says to Moses, say to Aaron, take your staff and stretch out your hand over the waters of Egypt, over their rivers, over their streams, over their pools, over their reservoirs of water, that they may become blood. And there shall be blood throughout all the land of Egypt, both in vessels of wood and in vessels of stone. All of their stored water is going to be turned to blood as well. Now, if you're Pharaoh, and you're the head honcho of about 5 million people, and somebody just told you that if you don't let these people go, their God is going to turn your main source of water, your main source of agricultural success and prosperity, to something that you can't even use, mightn't you at least want to think a little bit about that? A wrong decision here could mean pain and suffering for 5 million people. Leadership matters. But he doesn't care. Moses and Aaron did even as the Lord had commanded. He lifted up the staff, struck the water that was in the Nile in the sight of Pharaoh, in the sight of his servants, and all the water that was in the Nile was turned to blood. And the fish that were in the Nile died, and the Nile became foul, so that the Egyptians could not drink water from the Nile. And the blood was through the land of Egypt. It happened just as God said it would happen. The warning that was ignored came to pass. Bad leadership is bad. Good leadership is good. Bad leadership is bad. This guy is a bad leader. He just let unnecessary pain and suffering be inflicted upon his entire country. Who knows how long it took for the agricultural impact to kind of settle out. And what keeps him hardening his heart and defiantly disobeying God is because he's got some guys that convince him that the God that just demonstrated this to him is no better than his gods. He has some magicians, verse 22, who did the same thing with their secret arts. Now, we've talked before a little bit about this. We can't beat our chest too hard on exactly what's going on here because we're not told enough. What we're all told is that Pharaoh's got this class of magicians that did something that makes him think that his guys are just as good as God's guy. Some people think it was some sort of sleight of hand. I don't know how you can do a 4,000-mile river or even the part that just goes through Egypt and turn the whole thing into blood 25, 35 feet deep, and that's sleight of hand. But they did something. Perhaps it was facilitated by satanic help. Is that a possibility? Satan can do some stuff, can't he? I don't know that I know everything he can do. I don't know that I would argue that I know everything that he can do. But he can do some stuff. And we know that. He did some stuff to Job, remember that? Afflicted him with some boils and some things like that. So we know he can produce something that certainly looks miraculous. He's going to do that during the tribulation period, Revelation 13. Remember that? So perhaps he assisted these guys with some sort of satanic power where they maybe got him a little bucket of water handy there to Pharaoh and said, look, we can do the same thing. And they did something and it convinced him that they were just as good as the God of Moses and Aaron. I don't know. Does that make sense that Satan would help evil men? If he thinks he can thwart the plan and program of God, he would, wouldn't he? Yeah, he will assist evil if he thinks he can somehow or another interfere with God's plan. So perhaps the work of the magicians here should be understood as some sort of satanic involvement. I think it's a little hard to imagine some sort of trick on the scale of these plagues, so that's kind of what I think it is. But it's enough, however, to convince him to ignore what God demanded of him and the warning that God gave him through Moses and Aaron. He just ignores all of that. He did not listen to them. His heart was hardened in verse 22. He did not listen to them as the Lord had said. So Pharaoh turned and went into his house and had no concern even for this. Let his countrymen work it out as best they can. He doesn't care. So the Egyptians got busy trying to dig around the Nile for water to drink, for they could not drink the water of the Nile. And 7 days passed after the Lord had struck the Nile. So they have to do what they have to do to try to get some water. I guess they started digging around the edges like gypsy wells and seeing if they can get some filtered water come through there that they could possibly drink. And they had to get work. Now, if you're Joe Sixpack in Egypt and you've been worshiping the gods of the Nile all of your life, and you're out there on the end of a shovel trying to get something you can drink, because your God had just suffered this major smackdown by Moses' God, what would you think about your God, the gods of Egypt? You probably wouldn't be terribly impressed, would you? You might think, wait a minute, Harold. My God that I've been taught all my life, that's the God of this river, who protects it and blesses our lives through this river, all of a sudden, that guy is impotent. He can't do anything because this guy's God just turned the thing into blood. So you would probably start to doubt a little bit about the potency of the gods of Egypt, wouldn't you? And God, in his mercy and grace, did not let this go on too long. It looks like maybe it just lasted 7 days. If his intention was to kill off all the Egyptians, he could have done that easily enough. That was not his intention. His intention was to reveal to them the things about himself that we talked about there earlier. This is a lesson in learning for them, not a execution of sorts. So the 7 days looks like it was just long enough to make the point real clear before the next plague comes along. So 7 days of reflection could take place on the part of the Egyptians as they're out there digging for water every day and getting nowhere. And the frustration levels must have been very, very high. And they probably are getting the point. And wait a minute here. Something ain't right. Our God ain't doing too good. That's plague number one. Plague number two involves frogs. Now, if it seems odd to you that a frog has got anything to do with anything, it would make more sense if you understood that frogs were another one of their major gods. They worship the frog. So frog is a main player in Egyptian society. And normally, the croaking of frogs in the nighttime air and so on would be a good thing, because it is an indicator that the Nile has flooded into all these low-lying areas, these ponds and pools and all this stuff. The frogs have bred as a result of that, and they're doing good. A significant frog population would be a good sign, normally, in Egyptian society. It just indicates that the Nile is cycling like it should, and agriculture will probably progress like normal, and things are good. Is it possible to have too much of a good thing? Yeah, look what happens here. So the Lord says to Moses, go to Pharaoh and say to him, thus says the Lord, there is no questioning where this command is coming from. God says the same thing to him that he told him before, and it's black and white. There's no questioning it. And so it's very perfectly clear to him again, let my people go, that they may serve me, not you. And if you refuse to let them go, warning number two, I will smite your whole territory with frogs. The Nile will swarm with frogs, which will come up and go into your house and into your bedroom and on your bed and onto your houses of your servants and on your people and onto your ovens and into your kneading bowls. Used to play tennis a lot on Saturday mornings. Some guys from the church here, we got together and we'd play. And we played a lot of times at a park down on the lowlands down there where Abram floods, down there in the bottom down there, you know, where that is. There's some tennis courts down there. And so, you know, there's some water around there, and I'm sure the frog population down there was pretty good. And they'd get up on the tennis courts, and they would mess. And the place was a mess, and so we'd have to clean the tennis court up to play on Saturday morning. And it's just a few frogs, you know, probably no more than half a dozen or a dozen, maybe. Messed the whole darn tennis court up. These guys are going to be everywhere. It ain't just a few frogs. It ain't just a healthy frog population at a certain time of year. These guys are going to swarm all over the nation of Egypt. And if you've ever had birds, you know how messy birds are. Well, these frogs ain't a whole lot far behind them. They're going to be a stinking, rotten mess. They're going to be everywhere. The frogs will come up on you and your people and all your servants. So the whole place is going to be just inundated with frogs. Stinky, slimy, messing frogs. So the Lord said to Moses, verse 5, chapter 8, say to Aaron, stretch out your hand with your staff over the rivers, over the streams, over the pools, and make frogs come up on the land of Egypt. Now, they can't breed fast enough to just inundate the whole land. This is a miraculous calling forth of frogs. So Aaron stretched out his hand over the waters of Egypt, and the frogs came up and covered the land of Egypt. And they're everywhere. And the magicians did the same thing with their secret arts, making frogs come up on the land of Egypt. Now, I'm not sure how what they did was would prove anything if they're already inundated all over the land. What do you do? Just call a few of them up and say, hey, these are our frogs. We made these. But nevertheless, they do something enough here to convince Pharaoh again that his gods are just as great as the Hebrew God. Now, you might ask yourself, well, why don't they just eat themselves out of this situation? Kill those suckers and eat the frog legs, right? Pretty good delicacy. Just eat them. It's like sort of like manna from heaven, so to speak. Or the quails that are going to come in, you know? Good stuff. Let's just eat frogs for a while. Well, the reason they don't do that is because they worship the frogs. This is one of their gods. So they can't eat their gods. So they have to tolerate them and try to deal with them in some way other than eating them. So Pharaoh calls for Moses and Aaron and says, well, entreat the Lord that he may remove the frogs from me and from my people, and I will let the people go that they may sacrifice to the Lord. Sounds good, doesn't it? Moses, go ask your God to take these things away, and I'll let you go, and they can sacrifice to you. So Moses says to Pharaoh, verse 9, well, the honor is yours to tell me when shall I entreat for you and your servants and your people that the frogs be destroyed from you and your houses, that you may be left, that they may be left only in the Nile. So the request would be, when do you want me to go ask God to get rid of these frogs from everywhere except where they would normally be, and that is in the Nile? That part would be natural and normal, and they could live with that. So he says, tomorrow. What would your answer be? How about right now? Get these stinking, sliming messes out of here. Who wants another day of this stuff? Why do you think he put it off a day? Think maybe he was hopeful that the plague would sort of abate during that time, and then he could just kind of blow it off and say, well, you know, there ain't nothing to it. It went away on its own. So about this time tomorrow will be okay. That's a strange answer, unless he's expecting something to happen in that time frame to support his viewpoint. So Moses says, all right, may it be according to your word that you may know that there is no one like the Lord our God. Here's a lesson for Pharaoh. These frogs will be removed at exactly the time Pharaoh asked for them to be removed as an educational demonstration of God's power for Pharaoh. The Egyptians are learning about the Hebrew God. Pharaoh is learning about the Hebrew God. These plagues are educational. The frogs will depart from you and your houses and your servants and your people, and they will be left only in the Nile, which is where, of course, they belong. Then Moses and Aaron went out from Pharaoh, and Moses cried out to the Lord concerning the frogs which he had inflicted upon Pharaoh. And the Lord did according to the word of Moses, and the frogs died out of the houses, the courts, and the fields. So they piled them in heaps, and the land became foul. So the only way of processing these things, like I say, they wouldn't eat them, they just have to shovel them up into big piles. I guess they burnt them, I don't know, buried them something. I don't know how they got rid of them. But it stunk up the whole land. Well, Pharaoh said he'd let them go if they did this, didn't he? To keep his word in verse 15. When he saw there was relief, he hardened his heart and did not listen to them as the Lord had said he would. So here's another golden opportunity. First of all, he had the warning ahead of time. He could have obeyed God before having to live through this stinking mess. But after it was taken away from him, he broke his word and did nothing. He hardened his own heart against the demand of God. Now, we've talked about Pharaoh being the prototype of the godless man. You can see in his behavior here what's going to happen to any man who sets himself up in opposition to the plan and purposes of God. It's just a matter of time till this guy gets ran over. He cannot thwart the plan and purposes of God. And any man who tries to, by hardening his own heart, is just going to get crushed in the process. And yet, here he goes. He's going to do it. Third plague involves something like lice. Then in verse 16 of Exodus 8, then the Lord said to Moses, say to Aaron, stretch out your staff and strike the dust of the earth, that it may become gnats throughout all the land of Egypt. Some kind of a little bug-like critter. Perhaps gnats the right term to use. Maybe lice is the right term. But it's like when he strikes the dust that the surface of the ground all throughout the nation turns into these trillions and trillions of bugs. And so they did so. Aaron stretched out his hand with his staff and struck the dust of the earth. And there were gnats on man and beast. All the dust of all the earth became gnats throughout all the land of Egypt. Couldn't get away from them. They're everywhere. It's like the dust, the surface of the ground, the dirt, turned into bugs. So he calls his magicians, like always, and he said they tried with their secret arts to bring about these gnats. But they could not. They could not reproduce this same miracle on the third one here. The first two, they did something. We're guessing exactly what it was, perhaps some satanic involvement. But on the third one, they couldn't do anything. Clearly, Satan has his limitations, if indeed he is involved here. He probably is. He can do stuff, for sure, but it is limited. 2 Thessalonians 2:9, Satan's work is displayed in all kinds of counterfeit miracles, signs, and wonders. I think we would, if we underestimate what he can do, we do so at our own peril. He can do some stuff. He can rebel, Isaiah 14. He can tempt, Matthew 4. He can deceive, Revelation 20. He can accuse, Zechariah 3. He can hold sinners captive in their iniquity, 2 Timothy 2. He can torment the elect with certain types of inflictions and so on, Job chapter 2. So we know he can do some stuff. But he can't do everything. And he could not replicate this third miracle, this turning the surface of the ground into gnats or lice or some kind of a critter that was not pleasant and nobody wanted it around to be on them. And the magicians have the good sense to recognize the differentiation just took place here. Magician said to Pharaoh, "Hey, this is the finger of God. This one," they said, "is the power of God at work, because our guys can't do this. The gods of Egypt cannot do this." So his own counsels tell him, another education lesson for him, that this is the power of God at work. But his heart was hardened, and he did not listen to them as the Lord had said. Some people are very slow learners, aren't they? Look what's happening to this guy in his country, to his 5 million or so people who are suffering needlessly because he is a hard-hearted, defiant rebeller against the God of the Hebrews. Remember, we saw from the New Testament last week that ignorance is what produces the hard heart. He's ignorant of God, and that's what causes him to have a hard heart. And he's remaining in that condition now through the third plague. Let's look at one more of them here this morning. The fourth plague. The Lord said to Moses, "Rise early in the morning." There's our trigger point for the next set of three. Remember, that's kind of the key for the introduction of a grouping of three. Rise early in the morning, rise early in the morning, rise early in the morning. Three, three, three. So the next three begin with this one, this plague of flies. "Rise early in the morning, present yourself before Pharaoh as he comes out to the water." Again, he's probably paying homage to the gods of the Nile. "And say this to him, 'Thus says the Lord, let my people go that they may serve me.'" Black and white demand, just like before. Nothing tricky, nothing new. And then he warns him again. This is his third warning. "If you will not let my people go, behold, I will send swarms of insects on you and on your servants and on your people and into your houses, and the houses of the Egyptians shall be full of swarms of insects, and also the ground on which they dwell." Now, I'm not sure exactly how this one differs from the previous one, other than it appears to be maybe even more irritating that you get these insects that are everywhere. But here's a difference in this case. "But on that day, I will set apart the land of Goshen, where my people are living, so that no swarms of insects will be there, in order that you may know that I am the Lord in the midst of the land." These plagues are differentiating, aren't they? They're distinctive. They're going to be applied to certain people, but not other people. God's people, God's elect, God's chosen, are not going to be the recipients of these plagues. God is going to make a distinction between them and treat the Egyptians different than the Hebrews. Clearly, God's elect are distinguished from the lost of this world. I don't think I've ever heard anybody using this argument for a pre-tribulation rapture, but I'm going to use it here just for the fun of it. This pattern that you see here of God protecting his people and differentiating them from judgment, does that not argue also for a pre-tribulation rapture? We're out of here before those judgments come. Seems to me this pattern we're seeing here, where his elect, his chosen, his redeemed, are set apart and protected from the judgments here in Egypt, just like we think they're going to be during the tribulation period. We're out here at the rapture, and the rest of the world suffers those horrific judgments of the tribulation period. Have I shown you my arguments for a death rate greater than 99% during the tribulation period? Have I shown you that in here? 99.7%. I can show you a biblical argument that I think makes sense. I can't find a reason that it doesn't work. That says the death rate during the tribulation period is greater than 99%. 99.7%, actually. I've done that a few times. I think it probably was just in a Sunday class. That much of the world will suffer the judgments of God, the wrath of God, in the form of those judgments during the tribulation period. And remember what the Lord said about that time. He said, hey, if that thing went on any longer, nobody would survive it. So a high death rate is certainly a reasonable expectation, because God differentiates between the two, and he's going to do that here, and they're going to learn that. He is God in the midst of the land. He can control this land and do what he wants to, and so he's going to put a division between the Egyptians and the Hebrews. I'll put a division between my people and your people. Tomorrow this sign shall occur. And then the Lord said, verse 24, and there came great swarms of insects into the house of Pharaoh, and the houses of his servants, and the land was laid waste because of the swarm of insects in the land of Egypt. Now, these are not the locusts that are going to come later, but whatever they are, they're putting the hurt on the country real good, too. They're laying it waste. So whatever these insects are in this particular plague, this fourth one, they're damaging and hurting the nation as well. So Pharaoh decides, well, I'll get God to compromise. I'll offer him something, a deal that he can't refuse. So Pharaoh called for Moses and Aaron, verse 25, and he said, go sacrifice to your God within the land. So you can, Moses, you can do what you want to do, but just don't leave the boundaries of Egypt. Remember what God said? Let them go 3 days' journey into the wilderness so that they can worship me. So he tries to compromise with God, but God doesn't compromise. His demands are always the same. They don't change. And so that isn't going to work out. Moses said, he's not right to do so, for we shall sacrifice to the Lord our God what is an abomination to the Egyptians. And if we do that, if we sacrifice what is an abomination to the Egyptians before their eyes, will they not stone us? Hey, if we're out there sacrificing animals that you guys worship, that you think are gods, we're burning them up in sacrifice to our gods, you're not going to just stand there and tolerate that. You're going to attack us. So he said, no, we can't do that. We cannot sacrifice in the land. We must go 3 days' journey into the wilderness and sacrifice to the Lord our God as he commands us. So the compromise is not workable. Pharaoh said, I will let you go that you may sacrifice to the Lord your God in the wilderness, only you should not go very far away. Make supplication for me. Okay, I'll give you a little more slack. You can go outside the land. Just go into the wilderness just on the outside of the land. That would be kind of right in through here, let's say, up in this area. So you can just kind of take a step or two outside the land, but don't go very far. So go make supplication for me. Pray for me to your God to bring an end to this thing. So Moses said, behold, I'm going out from you, and I shall make supplication to the Lord that the swarms of insects may depart from Pharaoh, from his servants, from his people tomorrow. Only do not let Pharaoh deal deceitfully again in not letting the people go to sacrifice to the Lord. Knock off this lying that you're doing, Pharaoh. So Moses went out from Pharaoh and made supplications to the Lord. And the Lord did as Moses asked and removed the swarms of insects from Pharaoh, from his servants, and from his people. Not one remained. How is that possible? How can you obliterate swarms of insects so that every one of them dies? All multiple trillions of them die instantly. Well, you do it with a miracle, like God said these were. And what happened? Pharaoh hardened his heart this time also, and he did not let the people go. My goodness. Now, with this plague, we start to see the two-team concept developed in Scripture, don't we? We see God's team, and we see which is the team for good, and we see Pharaoh's team, which is a team for evil, and God is differentiating between the two teams. And Pharaoh clearly knows that there's a distinction being made between his people and God's people, but he still won't let them go. He still defiantly refuses to obey God. you got to kind of remember these things. When we get down to plague 10, that's going to be the one where the firstborn is killed. And you may ask yourself, well, wait a minute, now, isn't that a little unfair? Isn't that a little too rough? What does this guy deserve? How many opportunities has he had to avoid pain and suffering for himself and his people by simply obeying God? And he chooses not to. Yeah, he's had four already, and he'll have some more. So he's had his opportunities, but he just won't use them. And so when the severest of all judgments comes in just a little bit, we'll remind ourselves that he's reaping what he has sown. Okay, we'll throttle back this morning and give you a few minutes for questions. Any questions about these first four judgments? They're educational, they're triumphant, they're punitive, they're teaching people, they're punishing the disobedient ones here in Egypt. Lots of things going on with these plagues, and they are miraculous in nature. That's how we have to understand them, because they're too great to be understood any other way. Any questions about them? Yeah, Carol.
About how far is the land of Goshen from where the Pharaoh was, and I suppose Cairo?
He moved his... Carol's question is, how far are the Hebrews living in the land of Goshen from where Pharaoh's headquarters would be? And the answer is, he moves it around some. They have different palaces that they could live in. Goshen looks like it's up here in the northeast quadrant of the country. Remember, that was given to them when Jacob first went down there. And so they've lived up there apparently through all of the time. Sometimes the headquarters was down here at Memphis. And so, let's see, we got a legend on there. That's about 50 miles maybe. You could send a rider up there and get back in a day easily enough if you wanted to go kind of check on something up there. But Moses could be down there at Memphis or wherever. Exactly where he's going to the Nile to in the mornings to bathe and so on, we're not told. So I don't know the geography much more precisely than that. He's
during the first two plagues, was there still a division between the...
We're not told that, but I assume that there was. It looks like the Hebrews are exempted from all of these.
Yeah.
It's made, the point is made there with that third one very clearly, but it looks like on the first two that perhaps their water supply up there in Goshen was okay, and so on. At least that's what it looks like. It just isn't specifically stated. Yeah, Jerry?
I want to add something to the frog story.
Okay.
Several months ago, our neighbors had abandoned their pool, and every night you couldn't sleep because there was so much noise coming from next door. So I recorded it and sent the recording to a conservationist, and he said it was frogs mating.
Mm.
And the noise is so loud you can't sleep.
Yeah, I can believe that.
So that's kind of...
Yeah.
They're the fertility god.
If you haven't had any experience with frogs, these plagues may not seem all that great. But if you have, if you've seen this kind of thing and had to clean off a tennis court before you could play on it, you can see how stinky and rotten and messy those guys can be. This plague was severe, and they couldn't eat them. So what do? Try to gather them up into a box or something? You know, there's so many of them, they're everywhere. You can't manage it. They just inundated the country with these lousy, rotten, stinking frogs.
When did the frogs replace the rabbits?
Beg your pardon?
Fertility-wise, when did the frogs replace the rabbits?
I think they've always been there. It's just that the rabbits are just so good that the frogs kind of finish in at second slot or something like that, maybe. Yeah, these plagues are definitely disastrous. They are punitive. Bill.
Don, you say the Hebrew people were not suffering, though, from these plagues like the Egyptians were. How could that be? I mean, it looked like they would have been suffering from all that.
Well, because God can put a distinction between the two. Bill's asking, how could the Hebrews not suffer through all this like the Egyptians are? It would be only the result of God's providential care of them. We're not told about the first two, So I can't say for certain that was the case there, but we know at the third one for sure they're distinguished from the Hebrews and the Egyptians are distinguished from one another in terms of their experience in the rest of the plagues. So I'm assuming if it were on the first two also, but I don't know that for an absolute fact.